Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. I'm right here with my good buddy, Emil Kalinowski, who, like I said in an earlier video, came out with one of the best podcast episodes I have ever heard in my life on any podcast. Absolutely incredible. Emil, congratulations, man. I guess if that's the right word. I listened to that this morning when I was at the gym, and you and Snyder just completely blew me away.
Well, my mom is going to be very, very proud of me, finally, for the first time. That means a lot coming from you, George. I really appreciate it, but it's something that we're passionate about. I think you could feel it in our conversation. We were really upset with happening.
Yeah, but how you guys connected the dots at the tail end of the podcast and on the one episode you had up on your YouTube channel with this mass formation psychosis. And how you said, okay, this is an interesting hypothesis. Now let's take it a step further and try to figure out why society was in a mental state where they would be receptive to this in the first place. Why are we depressed as a society psychologically? Well, maybe it's because we're in an economic depression that would make things really add up. I mean, as an example, I did a story yesterday on these train robberies. Have you been following this in LA in the United States? I mean, it's staggering, the pictures.
It is appalling, and it speaks to the moral decay, the decay of leadership. Not the moral decay. I take that back. It's the decay of leadership, and which speaks to the wider lack of confidence that we, the people, have in our institutions. Because Well, it's the whole fourth turning. The institutions haven't been in place for such a long time. They're no longer functioning as they're supposed to. And to pile all on top of that, we're in the middle of an economic depression. And so it makes complete sense why we would be seeing those scenes. But no, I haven't heard that episode. So tell me, what did you say?
Well, regardless, I was just really reviewing what you guys said in your podcast, and I was trying to articulate it to the best of my ability. That's why I'm super excited to have you on right now, so maybe you can expand on a little bit further. But just to give you some more insight, some anecdotal stories, I think you grew up here in Phoenix, or at least you're very familiar with Old Town, and I live right by the Biltmore right now, right off of 24th Street and Camelback. And awesome. I lived right there in the Esplanade building back in 2007-ish, 8-ish, right around there. And
prime quality. That was a great location, right?
Yeah. And I mean, the Biltmore, remember the shopping area there? I mean, it was absolutely high end. It was packed every single day. And it was an awesome area. And now that area is just, it's like a ghost town over at the Biltmore. A lot of the stores are boarded up, but the homeless around there has been getting really extreme as of late. And Old Town Scottsdale has just devolved into a cesspool. I mean, it's really, really bad, in my opinion, especially on the weekends and in the evenings. I mean, it's not somewhere that you'd want to go with your family at all. I would be very concerned with the rate of crime there, especially on the weekends. But I mean, this is what I would expect to see in an economic depression. And it's unfolding right in front of our eyes. So when we see this headline nominal GDP number or real GDP number getting back to, let's say, its high watermark from 2019, and the mainstream media applauding and telling the average Joe and Jane that they should be excited, that what are you fear-mongering for? You know, why are you saying that your standard of living is decreasing? What are you, stupid? GDP is right where it was in 2019. And look at the quote-unquote GDP growth that we've had since 2008. What are you guys complaining about? But you and Jeff take it a step further, and you analyze how we're so far below trend. And I mean, I pulled up a chart just to try to explain what you guys were talking about. And I looked at the end of 2008, and if my memory serves me right, real GDP was roughly 16-ish. Trillion. And then going into 2020, it was right around 19. So $3 trillion of economic growth, but that was about, call it 18, 20%. And then based on what you guys did, I went back during the Great Depression and I pulled up the numbers from 1929, real GDP growth from 1929 to 1942. So basically a 12-year span, just like 2008 to 2020. And real GDP growth was 60%. 60. So we've gone from 60% real GDP growth during the Great Depression, for heaven's sakes, when we had soup lines, when we had, you know, all of these pictures that are, have become iconic throughout American history. And then we compare that to what we think has been, oh, well, not so bad. But yet we've been in this 30% increase after the last, quote unquote, recession or downturn in the market. And it just, it makes things so obvious that when you look at trend, which is what you have to do, that we have been in an economic depression, which we could probably argue is even worse in some periods and in some aspects than the 1930s.
That's what I did argue with, Jeff, that it is worse than the Great Depression in the United States on a per capita basis, as well as worse in Britain, Australia, Canada, and several other countries, and also worse than the Long Depression, which occurred during the late 19th century from 1873 to 1896, which culminated in the famous Cross of Gold speech, which was, again, all about the poor wealth inequality and the lack of money in the U.S. economy. And that's why William James Bryan wanted to introduce more money into the system, silver, which had been missing from the economy, much of like what we're talking about in the Great Depression. Money was missing then, money is missing now. It's just a different kind of money. And the other key point is the trend, because we're so used to the idea of positive or negative. If it's above zero, that's positive. So that's good. A positive is good. But as I tried to give the example in the show that we did, some positives are not good enough. For example, long distance flight records. If you look at each record for longest distance nonstop flight, increase at an exponential pace. Here's another record that we're a little bit more familiar with. It's the Moore's law of transistors on a microchip. It's supposed to double every 18 months or so. And it's been that way since the 1970s. If we fall off that trend, even if we did improve the long distance flight record, even if we did put in another transistor on our microchip, that's below trend. And it means that something's wrong. Same thing in the US, as you said, 60% growth during the Great Depression, which is something that we all agree on, was the pits. And we're doing worse than that. No surprise to your original point, to your main point, no surprise, mass formation psychosis. No surprise. Yeah.
What I tried to think through, well, a couple things there, because I argued in the video that even if we fix the monetary system, that still doesn't fix everything. Because at the end of the day, economic growth or economic activity, economic output is a result of capitalists and entrepreneurs out there taking risk. So even if they have access to the capital they need or the liquidity they need, they still need to have an incentive structure set up that prompts them to action. And so I try to think through, is it realistic that the regulatory environment gets better or worse moving into 2022, 2023? And I'm like, I don't see how it doesn't get worse. And then today, you know, the stock market was down another 450 points. And I know that you guys argue extensively that the Fed's balance sheet really doesn't have a direct causal effect with the stock market going up or down, but it definitely has a psychological effect. And there's a strong correlation with the Fed's balance sheet and the stock market going back to the GFC. When the Fed's balance sheet's increasing, usually stock market going up. If it flatlines or get QT, usually that puts a lot of downward pressure on stocks. And the way I look at it is I believe the economy is so financialized now that it is completely and totally dependent upon asset prices, more specifically stocks and housing. And if you have a stock market crash like Japan, you know, 1990, and Jeremy Grantham, I don't know if you followed that story, but he believes that we're going to have a stock market crash very similar to what we saw in Japan. What that means is the stock market goes down by, let's say, I'm talking about the S&P 500, let's say 45, 50% and does not recover. It just stays there for what, 10, 15 years, to the point where, if my memory serves me right, the stock market in Japan in nominal terms is actually lower today than it was in 1990. So now let's think about that. If we do have a stock market crash, if the Fed can't come in with their put, if the market finally says we don't believe your BS anymore, and the government can't come in and do, you know, $5 trillion in deficit spending, because let's just say headline CPI is at 7%, or even it's down at 5%. You know, if the average Joe and Jane sees their price of groceries go up, it's very difficult to go out there and argue why we should spend an extra $5 trillion this year if you're in the government's position and if you're trying to get reelected, which we know is their number one priority, right? So you've got the stock market coming down. You've got this this Great Depression, let's call it, since economic depression since 2008. And if the stock market goes down, doesn't come back, that makes the economic depression, that makes that trend line or the delta between the trend line and what we've seen, it exacerbates it even more. So my question, what I'm trying to think through, is if economically things get worse in the future, what does that do to this mass formation psychosis that we've seen in 2020 and continue on into 2022?
That's why I talked to Jeff about that. We have what started with a financial crisis in 2007. It transitioned to an economic crisis in 2008, one that I would suggest hasn't been resolved. Right. But that financial crisis then became an economic crisis. And then, because it hadn't been resolved, it transformed into a political crisis where we started seeing outsiders, rebels, Visigoths and barbarians and orange people and socialists come to the fore to try to take leadership positions, not just in the United States, but across Europe and South America. And then the last step is the social. Now we're in a social crisis. That's why I kept harping on the fertility rates and the life expectancy rates across the Anglosphere countries and how they have fallen. Because that's where we are, that it's escalating. And so to your point right now, you're saying, even if we fix the monetary part, even if we fix the economy, how are business people going to invest in this economy? How are people really going to believe that we can get out of this? I believe we cannot do it with financial and economic answers. We need a new social contract. We need a series of politicians to come in, just like during the Great Depression, just like during the Long Depression, to come in, just like previous fourth turnings in Anglo-American history, and set forth a new social contract that outlines what the future is like. Because I sincerely believe that people believe there's not much of a future and the laws are changing. We don't know what the future is. We need to come together, agree on what the future path is, a new order, a new institutional structure, hopefully the same institutions, but modified. We don't want to tear down all the institutions, at least in the Anglosphere countries, I would think. But that's what it's going to take, George. We're not going to just fix what the Fed is doing. We need someone with a vision, someone that will come to the fore and tell us, yes, you people are right. We have been living through a depression. This is unacceptable. And we've got to make wholesale changes. I know that we don't like exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did. He did radical things, radical. And so did Lincoln. Crazy, radical, insane things that we would not approve of at that time, completely upending the system. But both of those leaders knew we were entering a new era and things had to be changed completely. And that's what we need to see, I believe, from our politicians, so that we could come together, agree on a future, a new social contract. And therefore, I think then we would have the investment, an economic rebound, and a rip-roaring economy.
Yeah, my concern is that makes the environment ripe for an authoritarian dictator type that comes in and claims that they've got all the answers to all of our solution or all of the solutions to all of our problems. And all we have to do is just give them dictatorial power and don't worry about it. You just let me handle it. And people get so desperate for change and so desperate for someone riding in on a white horse that they grant them those powers. And then they, as history shows us, it's very rare that the individuals in society get that freedom back. And a lot of times that puts the society on a very, very, very slippery slope. And I think we saw that play out in Germany. I mean, you had what transpired after World War II. And then the what was the agreement at the end of World War One? I misspoke there. I meant World War One. It was
the Versailles Treaty.
The Versailles Treaty. That's right. And then that leads to all this economic malaise in Germany. That leads to the hyperinflation, and that brings on one of these authoritarian dictators that says, "Hey, I've got all the answers. All you have to do is just follow my lead." And, you know, then you see the propaganda in the media, you see the propaganda in the entertainment sphere, in the educational system. They try to get you to abandon critical thinking, which is one thing that we're seeing constantly throughout the media right now. You know, they're telling you that they're making fun of people who are actually doing their own research regarding the quote unquote science, which is another thing that you and Jeff hit on, which I think was fantastic. But then, you know, they set up a boogeyman. We all know who the boogeyman was back then. And it seems as though, again, society is just ripe for one of those individuals. That's why I'm very, very uneasy when I hear people say that we need to have a political solution or a political leader. That's where the solution is going to come from. That may be true, but boy, that I get I'm very hesitant to go that direction.
It's we just have to do our Hail Marys, pray, do what you're doing right now with the Washington, D.C. march. And thank God that we are in an Anglosphere country, which, you know, our founding fathers built institutions that have been able to dampen this volatility.
Yeah.
Successfully so far. There's no guarantees about the future, but I don't believe, honestly don't believe that there's no easy way out of this. We are going to risk a lot. It is going to be unpleasant. You and I, George, are not going to be happy with the things that come out of it, probably. But maybe we'll also be satisfied that maybe this was for the best and now there's a settled future ahead. I've always wondered what those people thought during the leading up into the American Revolution, leading up to the Civil War, leading up to the Great Depression. It was a totally different America, completely different and unrecognizable. Were they happy that the worst of it was over, but then now they were in a brand new America that they didn't recognize? And I wonder what that feeling is going to be like. If it turns out for the best, George, if it turns out for the worst, then we'll be reenacting The Road by Cormac McCarthy. That's also a nightmare scenario.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for. I know you and Jeff talk about the bond market extensively, and rightfully so, because that's historically been the quote-unquote smart money. But I'm trying to think through the stock market over the next few months or into 2022, if the Fed, you know, increases their rates, if they do quantitative tightening. I know that has a big psychological impact. And I think that's why we've seen the market go down since they announced tapering. If you look at a chart of risk assets, if you want to throw Bitcoin in there, they really match up with once the Fed started or announced, tapering November 3rd. I think they started tapering around November 15th or so. And since that time, the market has really, really struggled. It's gone up, gone down, but on net balance, it's quite a bit lower. And Bitcoin, just a very distinct chart, distinct correlation with their tapering. So what if we get this these interest rates hikes, which I think you guys would argue, just like what the Fed's done in the past, they're always behind the curve. They're always reactionary. And this, they're going to be heightening or tightening rates into a declining economic environment. And we're going to see a flattening of the yield curve. And I would assume that in that environment, stocks most likely go down. But I don't hear you guys discuss your ideas on that too much. Have you guys looked, or what is your idea? Let's set Jeff aside for a moment. What do you think about that?
My idea is that for all the problems that the United States has, it seems to be much worse elsewhere. Mm. And that, yes, I expect stocks to suffer should the Federal Reserve put out a hawkish narrative, whether or not that actually translates to anything in the monetary realm. But there's so much money out there outside of the United States that I would expect that eventually stocks would be going up again, as U.S. stocks are seen as safe havens in the rest of the world. We have monopolies, fantastic monopolies that are making money hand over fist. So I would expect that it's not a long-term Grantham-like disaster. Mm-hmm. That's what my expectations is because the rest of the world is uglier.
Okay.
But then
I think Brent would agree with you guys.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Brent Johnson.
Then the Mr. Russell Napier thesis comes into play here, where he says, should the government actually pursue financial repression and impose requirements on major financial institutions to finance the government by forcing them to buy government securities, then those financial institutions would be forced to sell stocks because they have to find money on their balance sheet. So that would be his thesis. But barring that sort of move, during the Long Depression, stocks went up. During the Great Depression, stocks went up after their fall, right? So right. If you get out of the way of the collapse thereafter, it seems like the natural, at least in the United States, natural direction is up. Japan scenario would be I haven't contemplated that.
Yeah.
I find it hard to believe because the United States is still the best place, seemingly, compared to everywhere else.
Yeah, that is true. When the Japanese market crashed, there was somewhere else for capital to go. They could just go over to that's right during the .com or the beginning of that. So that capital could flow over to the United States, it could go to Europe, it could go to all these other places, emerging markets, maybe, if they were a thing during the 1990s, I don't really recall. I guess that was more the 2000s. But that capital could have gone to the United States, where now if it leaves the United States, to your point, where does it go? Who knows? It's definitely a much different environment than we had globally back in 1990 when Japan collapsed. Now, another question that I'd have for you is, I know when you guys discuss money and what is money and how does it actually work, that you guys really don't consider the Fed's balance sheet as having anything to do with money whatsoever, at least in the real world and in the real economy. So would it be safe to assume that real money pretty much only exists on the balance sheet of the commercial banking system? And maybe I would go so far as to say even on just the liability side of the commercial bank's balance sheet.
I believe so, yes. Yeah. At least in advanced economy money centers. In emerging markets, where the banks are not really too enthused in creating money out of thin air in that particular currency, then those central banks have a lot more sway. That makes sense. But you know, but in advanced economy money centers, when they're where there's money to be made, yeah, the bankers are the ones that create the vast majority of money and the liability side. What did I haven't listened to the podcast yet. I guess your audience has, but what would Mr. Joseph Wang say to that? Would he agree or disagree with that?
I hate to put words in his mouth, but if I think that Joseph's view is post GFC, the majority of dollar transactions, especially domestically, are settled on the Fed's balance sheet, are settled on the liability side of the Fed's balance sheet. So i.e. bank reserves, and that's how they're settled. So if B of A is sending a $1 billion liability to Wells Fargo, that's the asset that's going to match up that liability is going to be a transfer of bank reserves from the sending bank to the receiving bank. So that's how you're going to match up that liability with the asset. I think that's where he looks at things from. Again, I hate to put words in his mouth, but from a standpoint of the Fed's balance sheet being a part of that settlement process with the majority of the transactions that are occurring, even outside of the United States, if you've got banks that have I don't know if subsidiary is the right word, but maybe an intermediary bank that they work with. You know, if Cayman Island Bank was sending a $1 billion liability to French Bank, then that liability would go over there, but they'd have that other bank in the United States that if both of those banks had an account with, that would just, that would settle on the liability side of their balance sheet because it just go from one account to the other, and it really wouldn't affect the reserves, the bank reserves on the Fed's balance sheet at all, but it still would happen domestically within the United States. So it's more of a kind of a Fed centric view where if I understand your guys' position, you say, okay, we get that there's some transactions that are being settled on the Fed's balance sheet, but we believe that the majority of the transactions, at least between banks, and maybe not at a retail level, but at least at a wholesale level where banks are sending, you know, billions, trillions of dollars worth of liabilities back and forth, that those assets are really just on the bank's balance sheet. And sometimes they're not even on the bank's balance sheets. They can just have basically a ledger system that is in the shadows where if Bank A is sending Bank B a $1 billion liability, and let's just say they don't have the assets, well, they can just tell the receiving bank that, hey, we'll pay you in 2 weeks, or we'll settle up in 6 months or something like that. And if the receiving bank is okay with that, then basically it's fine. The receiving bank basically extends them credit for the assets that are owed. So that receiving bank has an asset that is that loan and or the credit that's been extended. They've got the new $1 billion liability. And then on the sending bank's balance sheet, they have reduced their liability, the deposit liability, but then they increased by the same amount with that loan that they owe the receiving bank. So it's all of those settlements, if you will, are done on the bank's balance sheet outside of the purview of the Fed. So if I was going to describe the differences between your approach, it's really one's kind of more Fed balance sheet centric and the other is more commercial bank balance sheet centric, and not even what you see on the commercial bank's balance sheets, but what you don't see that goes on from bank to bank on the wholesale level,
over the counter.
It's in the shadows.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good people can disagree. And I'm glad we have somewhere where we can go. The Rebel Capitalist Show. unlike some of the mainstream media where you can't have disagreeing viewpoints on it, because then, oh boy.
Yeah. Well, what's really fascinating to me is that there's no way to really, you can't just Google this and say, where are the, I've looked into the chips system. I've looked into, you know, how Swift operates, how Fedwire operates. I believe the system in Europe is called BACS, B-A-C-S, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe there might even be one called CHAPS that might be for the Europe. But I've tried to do as much homework as I possibly can on the settlement process and try to think through all of these thought experiments. Like, what if you've got Cayman Island Bank that, you know, another thing, I go prior to the GFC, and maybe you can help me think this one through. I go prior to the GFC, and Jeff points this out all the time, how the entire banking system in the U.S. or the Fed's balance sheet, you had about $40 billion in reserves. And you think about how many dollars existed in the around the in the global monetary system back prior to the GFC. Let's just say it was $30 trillion, you know, probably a lowball estimate. And you're like, how, even domestically, let's say there was $5 trillion worth of deposits, might not have been all checking deposits, but saving deposits. And I don't even know if that would include money market funds, but say it was around $5 trillion. And you're thinking, how on earth can all of that be settled on the Fed's balance sheet? And it seems like it would be almost impossible unless they were just, you know, settling at the end of the day. And the difference between, you know, you could have $1 billion go back and forth between banks, but at the end of the day, the delta could be $5. You know, and that's all there's, I mean, was it something to that degree? It makes more sense, at least prior to GFC, that everything or 95% of the transactions were settled in the shadows, or at least on the bank's balance sheet, where those banks could create those interbank assets and liabilities that the Fed didn't even know about. You know, they weren't even part of the transaction in any way, shape, or form. And then I try to take it to an extreme and say, okay, let's say there were, let's say back then you had a 10% reserve requirement, which you had, and then, or for the big banks, at least in the United States, but not outside the United States. So let's say we had $30 trillion. Let's just say that all of that had to come back at one time for whatever reason, you know, let's take it to an extreme. How does that work? That there's not that, not even close to the reserves to back that up, if those were checking deposits or deposits of any kind. And then, so what would the banks just say? We can't take those incoming flows. We can't take those incoming dollar liabilities. I mean, it doesn't seem like that would be realistic at all. I don't think the bank, like JP Morgan or Wells Fargo, I try to think through, were they ever balance sheet constrained? You know, did anyone ever come to them with $1 billion loan applicant where they could make a ton of money and they said, oh, sorry, we can't do the $1 billion loan because we just don't have enough bank reserves, right? Or, exactly. You know, that
exactly.
XYZ corporation in France transfers a $1 billion liability to Wells Fargo or JP Morgan here. And they say, oh, shoot, I'm sorry. We can't take that, that $1 billion deposit, even though we love your business, because we just don't have the bank reserves to back it up at a 10% reserve requirement. I just can't, that doesn't seem realistic to me.
I remember Eric Townsend once saying, and now I'm paraphrasing, that bankers' greed is one of the fundamental laws of the universe.
Yeah.
So it's the weak and strong nuclear forces, gravity, electromagnetism, and bankers wanting to make money. You can bet your bottom dollar that if there's money to be made, they will work through, in, around regulations. And that's yeah, right. The whole point of the Eurodollar system.
Right.
And as
right.
Jeff often says, that Eurodollar system was reserveless. And it was based on confidence and that's it, confidence.
Yeah, cashless and reserveless.
And I have confidence that your independent directors, your lawyers, your auditors are good enough that they confirm that your promise is good? From what I hear on the street, do I have confidence that you will make good if I need you to provide that cash, that money, which I don't need you to. I don't want you to provide me cash, but do I have confidence that you will be able to? And that's what it was, confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And I specifically mentioned cash there because I think that would be one thing that would constrain a bank if they had something that an IOU to the customer that was redeemable for something that they couldn't produce. I mean, I know it's cash, you can print it out of thin air, but the bank itself, unless we're in free banking system, they can't produce those green pieces of paper, but they can produce as many electronic liabilities and assets as they want, just so long as the confidence game is still running on all eight cylinders.
I heard that episode of yours where you talked about cash and gold and how we're at a point now where it's, you don't need to produce anything, just IOUs, and you need to satisfy your auditors, your legal team, your shareholders, the regulators, and if you can manage that risk and that you will make good on your promise, then you don't have to produce anything. That's confidence, as we've always said.
Yeah, and I think now that there's $4 trillion in reserves on the Fed's balance sheet, maybe a lot more of the dollar transactions, especially domestically, are settled there. That would make a lot of sense to me. You know, maybe even the majority, but it's still, I think there's got to be a mix of both. You know, one thing I'd really like to get your opinion on, I was trying to think it through the other day, and really what it boils down, you know, you ask how can a bank go bust? If there's just two banks and they have confidence in one another and they can create the assets, they can create the liabilities, what would make them go bust? Like it's just basically accounting rules. So what if they just have different rules, right? And I take it to an extreme to try to understand it better. And I'm like, what if there were just two banks? So all it was just confidence in between them and the liabilities would just go back and forth. Would they even need assets? Like they really wouldn't. And it gets to a point where it's like trying to ask yourself if the score